Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Welcome to the Inside Lacrosse Fall Podcast. I'm Matt Kinnear, joined by Terry Foley and Kevin Brown. It's been an exciting week, probably one of the biggest weeks of the fall season, and we were all over the place watching some fall college lacrosse at practices and at scrimmages. Kevin, we're going to start with you. How's your week?
Great. Nuts. It was awesome getting out to a few practices. You know, we had our nice IL Women IDX event that went smoothly, and went down to Charlottesville after that. Was down in Georgetown before, and they're bitter Delaware rivals now. I hit first in Newark, so it's a lot of cool teams to see live.
A lot of heavy hitters, and Terry, we're going to start with you because you had the heaviest hitter of them all, the team that gets the most attention of anything that we do on Inside the Cross, and that is the Syracuse Orange. And they come in with the number one recruiting class in the country, Joey Spallina, the new number 22. This was the first action that people got to see them in person. They had a scrimmage against the Hill Academy earlier in the fall, and they've obviously had some of their own internal stuff. But this is the first eyes that anyone outside the organization really got on Syracuse. So we're going to start with there. And Terry, just what are your overall takeaways with Syracuse 2023?
So they move the ball so well. When they had their first midfield line, which was composed of three freshmen in Finn Thompson, Luke Roa, and Michael Leo, combined with a redshirt sophomore in Owen Hiltz on the left side, a freshman in Joey Spallina at X, and a grad student in Alex Simmons on the right side, the ball just zipped around in ways that were both very effective, incisive, creative, incorporated into the way in which the players were cutting and moving their feet. It was not a fluke. They did it on multiple possessions over the course of 30 minutes. Certainly, you can look at the Loyola defense that they were doing it against, and there were some questions. Cam Wires, an All-American defenseman, is still recovering from knee debridement that he had over the summer, and Peyton Rozanka is not on campus this fall as he's interning, and he's one of the best short stick team middies. The only Loyola Greyhound currently that's currently on the roster that's involved in the Team USA tryouts. But with that being said, it wasn't a function of the quality of the defense that they were going against. It was very much a reflection of the combination of skill and attitude. And when I say attitude, the best word for it is unselfishness, but that's not a good word for it because it implies that specifically when you compare it to the 2022 Syracuse offense, that they were selfish. And I don't think that was the case. I think that there was just a combination of, you know, Tucker Dordovic and Brendan Curry were, you know, go to the goal players. Lucas Quinn and Owen Siebold were shooters, finishers. It was just a combination of talent that, you know, both had very clearly defined roles that needed to be filled and skill sets that weren't zippy, accurate passers. So in that vein, I think that there's reason that Syracuse fans should be really excited because what I just described is super aesthetically pleasing and really exciting. But I also think it carries with it a little bit of risk because in addition to the fact that they're relying on a lot of young guys, which means that their performance is inherently going to be inconsistent and they're probably going to degrade over the course of the season because playing college lacrosse relative to playing high school lacrosse is really physically and mentally taxing. This style of play, even when you're upper class heavy, is higher variance. It's not as simple and consistent and reliable as having that Michael Jordan-esque Dodger who can get to his own spot, get a clean shot at the end of a shot clock or at the end of a game or when the cohesiveness of your passing oriented offense isn't coming together on that particular day.
Very, you know, I'm going to want a quick answer here. And, you know, this is kind of, you know, you did the top 20, the way ahead top 20 earlier in the fall. You've now seen Syracuse. You did not have Syracuse a part of that. You've now seen Syracuse. If you're a Syracuse fan after this weekend, Terry, do you feel better about them going to 2023, or do you feel worse, or do you feel the same?
The same and better, meaning that I stand by, I don't believe they're a top 20 team, but I feel better because if they end up being a top 20 team, I now see the pathway to getting there.
And the last question I'm going to have to you about Syracuse is, you know, we've talked about Joey Spolina since he's basically been in elementary school. You know, he's been on the sidelines of the MLL All-Star Game during the skills competition, World Series youth lacrosse, up through his, you know, career in high school and club. Kid loves pressure. You know, he said it after the end of the Under Armour game about how, you know, he wants the pressure to bring Syracuse back. But I think you brought up a really good point in your feature story that's going to be in this next magazine about Joey, and that he's a little bit misunderstood. You know, everyone sees him as Joey the quarterback because that's the role that's been most public that he's had. But Terry, what roles do you see him maybe filling through his career at Syracuse?
So one of the reasons that I'm so confident that he is going to meet and exceed whatever lowest standard it could be set for a player who is going to wear number 22 and is our number one ranked recruit is because he's going to score goals. And I think that against Loyola and even against High Point, where they struggled more than they did in their first scrimmage, which I think, again, is a reflection of the fatigue that sets in for a group of largely freshmen and underclassmen who aren't used to playing two Division I lacrosse games in a five-hour span. He's just open on the backside pipe. So even though he's capable of initiating the offense with the ball on his stick, whether that's through a 20-yard pass or a 15-yard dodge to a 10-yard pass, he's still capable of contributing and really valuably contributing by catching a 25-yard skip pass from Hiltz or Leo or whomever and finishing a dunk. So that level of versatility is something that justifies the decision to run him at X when I think when he was a sophomore in high school and coaches were thinking about recruiting him after having seen him play for the two prior years with those crush teams and being the beneficiary of feeds from Xavier Arline or Andrew McAdory or Brennan O'Neill or Aiden Denenza, and then seeing him graduate into this bulldodger that was able to get to the middle of the field and was also able to pull off a question mark. What I saw in the, you know, 35 to 45 minutes of watching him play on Sunday was a guy who can do both. He still has more to prove and show relative to that bulldodger at the D1 level, but he doesn't have a whole lot more to show or prove relative to his ability to score goals.
And Terry, I said that was my last question about Syracuse, but I lied to you. I'm going to ask you another one because it's the most interesting team in the country in some ways, at least the most newsworthy team in the country. And that is, you haven't really touched on their defense much. And with, you know, these kind of highly touted guys they have coming in on the defensive end. And remember, this is a team that we also made the number 5 transfer class in the country. They have a goalie, Will Mark from LIU, who has not been playing in the fall, but should be there in the spring.
He's been practicing, but he wasn't able to play in the non-team-based competition.
Correct. So you did not see him play against these teams in this past weekend, but you know, he will be there suiting up and, you know, presumably in the mix for a starter for them in the spring. But with all these highly talented guys that they have coming in, is this defense going to be better than last year?
I think so. I think that one of the reasons it might be roughly equivalent is because unless they get some answers at the faceoff X that right now are not apparent, they're going to play a lot more defense than they did when Jacob Fopp was winning faceoffs last year. But that being said, they are very clearly bigger and more athletic than they were last year just by virtue of the infusion of Billy Dwan and Jordan Beck, neither of whom started against Loyola, and who knows whether or not they will start. The unit was dealt a blow when Riley Figueres was injured. It's unclear at this point what the extent of that injury is, he's still going through imaging and we haven't gotten word yet, but I think that there's some pessimism that he might miss the 2023 season. That being said, in Nick Ekemo, Landon Clary, and Caden Cole, the three starters against Loyola, you have guys that have been in the system for a full year. Ekemo left the high point scrimmage with an apparent upper body injury. Brandon Aviles is a really, really good short stick D-middy, but beyond that, they need to cultivate their depth. I think that sixth guy, whether it's Carter Rice or any of a number of other newcomers, are going to get picked on, particularly early, just to test because Aviles is such a known quantity. And then I do think that they're going to have, I think long stick midi is going to be a strength. I think Sam Alexo is one of their best players last season. And then behind him, whether it's Tommy Drago or Michael Page, you've got youth that you can project to play well. And Dylan Segeter is another player who, you know, he's listed on the roster as a short stick D midi and was one of the better LSMs in the class coming out. So I think that there are options. I think that ultimately the reason that that defense struggled was less because they couldn't stay in front of Dodgers and more because of their inability to be organized off ball. So we'll see whether or not that's improved by a combination of the influx of freshman talent, specifically with Dwan. He is highly regarded as an off ball player, and with the guys who are back for another year under Dave Petromala's system, whether that increased familiarity yields more comfort in those off ball roles and less of the naked backside goal scorer. Like the one that stands out in my memory was, you know, that either game tying or game winning goal coming out of a timeout against Cornell when, you know, famously in the huddle, Dave Petromala said, "Don't go halfway." And that's exactly what ended up happening.
Terry, we're going to come back to you in just a minute for more on Loyola, High Point, and Villanova, but want to transition to Kevin a little bit and talk about, you know, a team that I don't know if Syracuse fans want to listen to this part, but Georgetown. Tucker Dordovic is kind of the crown jewel of the transfer here. The former Big East rivals, you know, I know Syracuse fans and Georgetown fans in all sports, you know, just have a historical hate for each other. So you went down and saw the Hoyas practice. You saw Tucker Dordovic in person with the Hoyas and, you know, the number one transfer class in the country. A team that had a disappointing finish in the NCAA tournament last year to Delaware, but a team that is looking to be one of the best in the preseason rankings coming into 2023. Kevin, how did Tucker look? But then expand that into what did you see and what was the main theme of Georgetown practice?
Yeah, first off, just got to say, if any of the listeners have checked out the graphic that we posted for our top 10 transfer class rankings, it is the perfect depiction of Tucker Dordovic dodging, because he, as you can see in the photo, he is in basically midair while he runs. And what he does is he basically jumps like 3 feet forward while he's in a full sprint and stops on a dime. Every defenseman goes 3 yards past him, switches hands, fires it bottom corner. It's pretty awesome to watch. He's so athletic, so much more athletic than anyone not named Will Bowen on the Georgetown squad. And he's just going to create matchup problems left and right for that offense, which is going to be really exciting to see how they incorporate their other transfers, including the North Carolina tandem. Nikki Solomon and Jacob Kelly were attached to the hip basically in every drill, which was funny to hear Coach Kevin Warren say after practice that they're usually not like that. And I was like, okay, sure. But they got weapons. Graham Bundy hasn't practiced all fall. Declan McDermott, he was out during the practice when we went to, just with a minor knock. But he has really taken a leadership role with that offense to bring guys like Dylan Hess along and some other guys that they're looking at. But it's the two-headed monster out of the midfield. It's really the headliner between Dordovic and Graham Bundy Jr. It's going to be tough. Like, who do you pull there? You know, it's choose your pick your poison with that offense.
So, I think it's interesting that you saw them and Delaware kind of in the span of, you know, a span of a week. You saw the two of them. And Kevin, sorry to interrupt you, but you know, the theme of that game against Delaware was just that Georgetown didn't play enough players. You know, they lost that game and they didn't go into their depth. Did you see depth facilitated there, you know, in D.C.?
I think they are still searching for the depth with bringing on some of the second line midfielders, second string rope unit kind of players. They're still working out the kinks with kind of who will step up in that regard. But there were plenty of guys who looked huge and athletic and were making big plays left and right with the they were doing a lot of full field drills. First time they were doing 6-on-6. They didn't put in man up, man down yet. So you brought up Delaware, though. It was really fascinating to see the contrast of philosophies clash with in 2 days. I saw Delaware on the Tuesday and Georgetown on the Thursday. Delaware was more of they're kind of still building up that foundation. It was working on the clear, working on the ride, making sure everyone was just dead set on fundamentals, building up the body strength, building up the speed. Coach DeLuca said it before practice. They still teach all the upperclassmen how to bench, how to plant and change direction. The contrast between that and Coach Kevin Warren's kind of laid back. Now, I can't say that he didn't start fall ball off like that. This is just from the practice I saw in contrast from the week that I saw these two teams. But Georgetown, they seem like such a complete team already, and they sort of know it, and they're just searching for the guys who are going to step up in those depths and reserve positions that they don't need to just play 18 players in the first round of the NCAA postseason and can maybe extend some possessions a little more. That's going to be important, but they just look more refined, and I think that speaks to the talent level across the board, which isn't to say, I mean, Delaware, as Terry wrote in his way ahead rankings, they return basically every contributing starter, every key player besides Captain Mark Bita. So it's going to be a they're certainly the CAA front runners.
Yeah, and I've been to practice there before in Newark, and you know, one of the things that always struck me was how much Coach DeLuca stresses the like consistent communication. You know, they have specific terminology, and like he will stop practice if like a guy did not use this right term, and you know, it's very much foundation building and stuff that you would presume is what makes you successful in May is this kind of stuff that you do in October and September. So, Terry, we're going to flip it back to you a little bit here and talk about some of these other teams that, you know, we saw in the set of scrimmage that you went to at Loyola. And we'll start with the home team, Loyola, who you mentioned. So we'll brief because you saw them in practice. We talked about them a little bit a few weeks ago, and they were really banged up. I think you got to see a few more of the guys who weren't at practice playing in the scrimmage, but, you know, obviously still a little bit shorthanded. Do you have similar thoughts about, and I don't remember the term that you used, but Loyola's ability to, even though there's some question marks, again, the injuries and all that stuff, the way the program's momentum kind of carries itself forward. Do you still have
that? Yeah, betting on the institution. Yeah, I do. I'm really glad that I got an opportunity to see them scrimmage because compared to what I saw in practice, where I was able to kind of analyze the component parts, seeing the whole sum was really valuable. So, you know, particularly seeing the way that the attack worked together, the way in which, you know, the first midfield unit is going to be a strength, and the fact that that is usually a really good sign for a team. The fact that it appears that they have a little bit more short stick D-midi depth than you might have otherwise assumed. And that Luke Stout played really well in goal and looks to be, you know, kind of having an edge in terms of that starting competition. Although I should say that Freeman Whitaker played well in goal as well. Again, you know, I had him, I think, 19 in my way ahead rankings, and that seems about right. I think that they also are going to struggle to face off. Eric Pacheco and Chris Cattone look like they're going to go roughly 60-40 in terms of splits. And, you know, neither has a ton of experience because Bailey Savio has been one of the significant mainstays in the sport for the last 5 years. So I think that, you know, they're a team that, like many, just kind of in order to improve on last year, need to do a couple of things. So, you know, they need to be 2, 3, 4% better in terms of their offensive and defensive efficiencies in order to close the gaps in some of the one-sided games that they saw. I'm not going to close the gap against Maryland, you know, based on how one-sided that game was, but then they need to close a little bit better, you know, in some of the more significant losses, you know, thinking of Hopkins and Rutgers. They held leads in late third quarter or fourth quarter situations. So where those improvements come from can vary game to game, and they can probably come from all over the field. But like Syracuse, and this is, I think, one of the reasons that that scrimmage was so valuable for both teams, one of the places it's going to come from is their freshman class. Now, I do think that Loyola is going to rely a lot more on a lot more older guys. So the burden on the freshmen individually is going to be lighter. But Luke Murphy is an example of somebody who didn't practice at the practice I was at. And he was, to me, the most impressive or revelatory Loyola player that I saw. He's an attackman from Boston who is just able to play all over the field, is the short answer of the question. He's Owen Murphy's younger brother. So, you know, between what he showed during his time at Hopkins and then last year at Maryland, another guy who can play attack in midfield and, you know, is kind of an all-around player in terms of his ability to dodge and shoot, and didn't show, you know, a ton of feeding or passing ability in this one, but at least represented the threat of doing so, and that danger, you know, kept defenses at bay such that it gave him space to get rid of a shot. So, you know, some of the known quantities like Joey Kamish and Evan James, who are really good shooters, Anna Poitra and Sagans, who are get to the middle of the field, Davis Lindsay, who can dodge the GLE and is very crafty once he gets there. You know, I'm still waiting to see a little bit more out of the youngest Minicus. It's funny because he's a type of player, it doesn't surprise me that I haven't seen it yet, because the absence of mistakes is a huge hallmark of his game, and it's just the type of thing that doesn't stand out. But he started, and talking to the staff after, they were pleased with his performance. So, you know, I think he's another example of, you know, a guy who's going to help raise the floor of this Greyhound team relative to what they put on film last year.
One of the other teams you saw this past week was Villanova, and you mentioned something in your write-up that I kind of want you to expand upon, because it's funny. Villanova, for whatever reason, and I think it's, you know, partially what people talk about on the ESPN broadcast or whatever, they have this reputation as being kind of this, like, slight, small, skilled team. But for the past probably 5 years, they've been, like, big, monster, tall guys. And their reputation hasn't followed them. You know, you mentioned John Clue. Like, it's kind of like John Clue was such a popular player back when he played that, like, that's kind of people's memory of Villanova is that.
Yeah.
They've had these monster guys. They had Colin Kirst went there. And
Christian Cuccinello is not small. The Ficaros are not small.
Exactly. And, you know, Keegan Khan's not, like, a little guy by any means.
Right.
So it's just funny that, you know, they've had this reputation. And you got to see their freshman. You know, Matt Campbell was not playing because he was sick. So that probably was a good thing because he's such a known quantity.
Yeah.
That we don't need to see him because we know how good he is. You saw all their freshmen. And, you know, one of your big impressions was these guys are really big. What else can you say beyond that?
Well, so to your point, just to make it clear, the format of the day was that there were two scrimmages going on at adjacent fields at 2 hours or 2 times, right? So there was one team whose starters I just wasn't going to be able to see. And it was Villanova's because felt the need to watch High Point Syracuse's first quarter relative to the need to watch Loyola Villanova's first quarter. Campbell's absence being a factor in that decision. But yeah, I mean, as far as the young guys are concerned, I mean, it was funny because I wrote that and then realized, like, but, you know, Luke Raymond's actually the one in this situation that impressed me the most, and he's the smallest. I think he's like 5'10", 180, sophomore out of Gonzaga, and he had a really nice take from X. You know, but when I was going through their extra man personnel late in their scrimmage against against Loyola, you know, I was like, all right, Lucas Newton is 6 foot, 195 pounds. Colin McNair is 6'3", 195. Luke Williams is 6'4", 185. Dan Martin is 6'2", 215. James Beagley is 6'5", 200 pounds. So it was like, that is a big, big group. And then, you know, one of the big distinctions between covering games in the spring and the fall is I don't watch games from the sideline in the spring, at least with very much regularity. And when you're watching from an elevated position, you don't get nearly two aspects of the physicality that you do when you're watching on the sidelines. So the first is how big these guys are relative to you. And then the second is how big they are relative to each other, right? So the difference between somebody who's 6'5 and 6'2 when you're watching 100 feet above is a lot less noticeable than it is when you're watching at their level and you yourself are 5'10. So it was just a stark takeaway. And you know, when you consider that Patrick Daly is also pretty big, I think he's 6'2", 200. You know, Tucker DeGaudel is a very thick 5'11", probably 190 at this point. You're right. It is funny. I mean, now granted, on the other end of the spectrum, Brett Baskin was a big contributor for this team last year. So it's not as if they haven't like fully, you know, abandoned that little skilled guys can be really significant contributors to the team. But when it comes to like a program-wide reputation, what program doesn't have a couple of, you know, 5'8", 165-pound guys that are scoring goals or, you know, throwing great passes or whatever the case may be? So it was more like a self-reckoning of I was trying to exercise the demon of this memory having an outsized effect on my opinion of Villanova as an offense.
Yeah, for sure. And I remember when they played like a Wednesday night game against Brown in the year that Brown went to the Final Four. It was like 4:30 on a Wednesday. It was a really weird time. And at the time, I believe both teams were undefeated. So it was a huge game, but it was just tucked in this weird like time slot that like nobody, and it was still cold out. I think it was end of February or early March or something like that.
We call those games McInnear specials.
Yeah. So those are my favorite types of games because they're the ones I actually get to like focus on solely. And I remember going to that game, and the Brown guys, you know, that team
were enormous.
And that was a very stark, you know, contrast to Villanova, who at that time was just a smaller team. But then I remember, you know, during the COVID year going Villanova versus Denver was one of the only games that I got to go out to in person because, you know, there were so many press box restrictions or whatever. And I watched that game from the sidelines, and I had that same thought of, like, this is the opposite. Villanova kind of towers over the Denver Pioneers here. So it's been a, you know, and I don't know if it's a conscious decision by the staff, but it has been something that has been progressing over the last few years. And Terry, we're going to finish up with your scrimmage notes by talking a little bit about High Point. You know, they probably among this group, I think it's fair to say, is the most experienced, which is weird to say, given my next question is going to be, they also have like the
biggest hole to fill.
Yeah, biggest gaping hole and the biggest, like, most, like, known or biggest question mark in terms of, like, how the heck do you replace this guy? And that's Asher Nolting because he's such just a, you know, not only from the way he plays, but just, like, his personality. He's just such a charismatic person that kind of, and I mean this as a compliment, not as a detriment, he dominates just the conversation because of just how talented he is, but also just dynamic of a person he is and charismatic. So how does High Point replace Asher Nolting?
Yeah, it is kind of funny in a reflection of the constantly disrespected High Point Panthers that they were the best team on Sunday, and we're talking about them last. So, to your point about their veteran presence, I mean, the simple fact is that they have the most old guys. And I actually learned this on Saturday. I didn't realize this, but the university is paying for 1 year of anybody like to come back as part of like the COVID situation. So that's one of the reasons that compared to other programs, they've had such a higher retention rate and had more guys come back. But the core of your question is, to me, it's the style that they're going to have to play. And they were always going to have to play without somebody as ball dominant as Nolting was. So in terms of you know, 1/6 of the offense and the guy whose responsibility it is to fill the space that Nolting previously occupied, that's Jack Van Overbeek. And it shouldn't be very difficult for fans to imagine what that looks like, because he did play enough last year that you can imagine seeing him slide into that role. And, you know, I really fixated on how different they look stylistically, because Nolting is so big and he played in such a crouch. He was so low to the ground, whereas Van Overbeek is really skinny and he plays really upright, that they just look a lot different in terms of the way that they attack from X. But the biggest difference is that now you get a guy like Braden Maia or Hunter Vines or Jackson Clay. Like, the ball is going to be in their stick more on a per possession basis than it was, you know, when Nolting had the ball for 30 seconds. And so what does that mean in terms of their efficacy? Some guys thrive by getting a little bit more of the ball. Some guys suffer. What does it mean relative to what they're asked to do? Ultimately, I didn't come away with answers to those questions. Like Syracuse, I came away with a little bit more of a picture of what it would look like or what it will look like. But at the same time, I don't think this is going to be something where the answer in game five is the same as the answer in game one or game two. It's going to evolve as the season goes along. And what's interesting about that is one of the things that appealed to the High Point staff about bringing Logan Wisnauskas on as the volunteer assistant is that he took part in a similar transition and arguably was the most important cog in making the transition occur when Maryland's offense went from being pretty similar in terms of Jared Bernhardt's ball dominance as High Points was to Asher Nolting last year to then what the staff hopes the offense can become this year. And I think that having Wisnauskas' firsthand experience in the film room, on the practice field, in the meeting rooms every day is really appealing in terms of understanding the beats, the pace, the ups and downs of how it's going to unfold.
Kevin, we're going to turn it back to you before I take the mic a little bit here. Virginia, you know, this is a team that won two straight national championships and then had the toughest matchup you can possibly ask for last year in the NCAAs when they had to play Maryland. This is a team that, you know, Lars Tiffany has made them, and I don't even know the phrase I want to go with here, but just has built an aura around this program. Obviously, winning two national championships does that, but just the way that he does things also has that effect as well. Kevin, take us inside. What is the vibe around a practice like at University of Virginia?
The practice vibes were quite furious. That these guys are absolute war. So the Lars, when I got there, was talking to there was a South Dakota Native American nonprofit there that their name is Nisto Inc. And he compared it. Basically, every drill would kind of promote this just ultra aggression of whether it's getting two pool noodles like checked at you as hard as you could while trying to pick up a ground ball, or every about six guys, every man for himself, ground ball to turn into 4-on-3 fast break. These guys were just absolutely getting after each other. And Matt, I've heard you talk about it more than once with St. Joe's in the fall and Yale in years past. These guys, I felt like I haven't been at those practices, but took it to another level. In the fact that I almost felt like I was in the Golden State Warriors practice facility when Draymond Green delivered that punch to Jordan Poole. So they were doing a sixes style half field, kind of three quarter field rather, drill. And you know, one thing leads to another. They're scrapping for a ground ball behind the goal. And Matt Nunes and Thomas Menke is, next thing you know, they're on the ground, fisticuffs. All these Virginia defensemen have to, like, pull them away. And moments later, whistle blows, they're right back in it. It's like nothing ever happened. Things like that just escalate. And when guys
Texas blood is thick as mud.
Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better myself, Terry. These guys were just going at it, like, oh my, like it was pretty cool to watch. though I know I would have just gotten eaten alive if I was ever in a practice like that. But it's something Lars Tiffany was saying. They don't promote kind of getting escalated like that, but it does happen about like once a week. And that kind of, I was like, oh, wow, to that level. And he's like, maybe not to that level. But it was just emblematic of the culture they're trying to instill and keep going with guys just competing for every spot. And, you know, this is a pretty severely injured fall ball for them. They've just had a run of bad luck with illnesses and some minor knocks and bruises here. So there's 18 guys out, a lot of starters, including Peyton Cormier hasn't practiced all fall. Terry mentioned last week that grad transfer Thomas McConvey from Vermont was in a sling. He wasn't in a sling in practice, but he was still sidelined. Guys like Xander Dixon, he was sick. Griffin Schutz was out. Grayson Soliday, Tiffany called the backbone captain of this team, whether it's kind of bringing things from the coaches to the players or vice versa. So it really kind of lent itself to Connor Schellenberger and Cole Kastner to step up as the two foremost leaders during practice, whether it's Kastner teaching guys like Malachi Jones and other underclass freshmen that, I mean, they've got a loaded freshman class coming in this spring, all the ins and outs of that 10-man ride, and Connor Schellenberger bringing people out before practice to shoot just about every time because, you know, that's his favorite thing to do in the world. And you can tell by those 4-3 fast breaks, he was canning every single one. I think I counted one that went high. So they're going to be a special group, and when they're competing that hard in the fall during practices, whereas Coach Tiffany called it, you know, they're allowed to do it here. And we're in a sport like this is tolerated at the NLL level and up north of the border. So it's like when things escalate and boil up like that, it's not too big a deal, but just seeing it live in person was something else.
Yeah. I think there might be, you know, we're talking about misconceptions a little bit here, and Lars is, you know, he's got this personality, this, you know, that has built around him, but he runs a tough practice, and like he demands a lot from his players. His players respect the hell out of him for that. But, you know, I've been to Virginia practice and they do go after each other. And, you know, similarly, when they aren't performing, you know, Lars will ask a lot of them. So it's not just, you know, because they have this, you can have fun and you can be like a very close team and you can have all this camaraderie and, you know, your perception of the game is in the right kind of headspace, but still have these clashes. That's kind of, that's a healthy part of the process overall. Is this, you know, it's probably, I think the teams I would venture to say that are the best teams have this as kind of part of their process, you know, this like very physical, demanding and tough practices, you know, this is where you get that out. And so I think it's probably a good thing, you know, if you're a Virginia Cavaliers fan.
Right. It was just funny to see, like, they have all these guys out injured, 18 guys, and they're just going at each other to send more to an injury list. Not really, but all those guys should be good for the spring, Coach Tiffany said. But, yeah, like you said, they're just absolute warriors down there. And it was really fun to watch. Pierre Garna was slinging them. Who else should I shout out? Malachi Jones was great off the ground. Still got to do the write-up, but plenty of guys that impressed down in Charlottesville.
Awesome. Anything either you guys want to know about the Navy midshipmen or the Rutgers Scarlet Knights? Who wants to set me up here?
Yeah, I'll take the first swing. So I think both these teams have established enough identities that asking what was similar to prior year's experience or different is like a reasonable starting point. So with Rutgers, certainly, you know, the transfer reputation or the role that transfers have played in the program's ascendance over the last couple of years is meaningful. And we just came out with our transfer rankings this week. They weren't number one like they were the last year, but at the same time, they have some significant contributors. So what did you see out of the new guys in Scarlet Knights practice And how does that inform your expectations for this team for the 23 season?
Yeah, you know, I'm in the same boat as Kevin, where I haven't written up my thoughts yet. So I'm kind of formulating them here on the fly. And the thing that really clarified things for me was I talked to Ross Scott for probably about 10 minutes toward the end of practice. And he mentioned how, you know, last year he had to take on a new significant role. You know, he was a midfielder. He kind of switched between an attack and midfielder in his first 2 years at Rutgers, and then was asked to basically be the quarterback of the offense. And, you know, he scored 75 points and led them to the championship weekend. You know, he had to take a new role and address it and, you know, move the team forward that way. There's a lot of people who that's going to be the case for on this Rutgers roster. You know, they have a pretty decent amount of graduations. They have 26 newcomers, over 20 newcomers, I think 20, between freshmen and transfers on this team. But it's not just like the freshmen being new. It's also guys on the team are going to have to take significant steps forward or take on a new role in order for this team to be successful. You know, Scott did it last year and, you know, was fantastic, you know, in that role. You know, I think of a guy like Bobby Russo as he's going to have to be the guy that makes, you know, this significant transformation forward in order for this team to be successful. He's going to have to be the number one defenseman. You know, he's going to have to be the vocal guy. He wasn't necessarily the vocal rah-rah guy before. And, you know, he's going to have to be basically be the guy on defense. And you have people like that throughout the roster. The thing that really impressed me most was watching practice. And after a drill, you know, it was kind of I want to say it was like a 4-on-4 or it was a small sided drill split into two halves. And Russo grabbed two of the transfers, two short stick D middies who were going to play, and basically had them under his arms and was explaining to them, you know, who's the hot guy and who shouldn't be the hot guy and some of the play calls on the sideline after practice. I don't think that's something that was in his personality in the years prior.
I want to interrupt you there to just point out that that was probably the strongest thing that I took away from watching Villanova on Sunday was the role that Chet Camizio plays, and particularly how he did it communicating with Aiden Ahern, a sophomore defenseman who was really highly touted coming out. That type of player-held accountability and teammates coaching each other is one of the best indicators that I have seen in my time attending practices and these types of like high-access scrimmages and other types of events in terms of saying like it's a good culture, it's a team that's going to be at least able to reach expectations or in some instances exceed them.
Right, and this is a very long way to go back to your initial question, which I haven't addressed about the new guys. And I think you need to understand with Rutgers, like as much as they've always had these transfers, they've always had a pretty significant core of players who have kind of been multi-year players for them that have guided along these transfers. So, like, you need a Bobby Russo to take care of, you know, all of these midfielders who are probably going to comprise the entirety of their rope unit this year, you know, their short stick D midi class, because that's the area of the field that really got decimated by injury. So we may not look at Rutgers transfer classes, you know, they don't have a Mitch Bartolo, they don't have a Cursed, you know, one of those, like, oh my God, kind of guys on this team. You could argue that Mullins is certainly in that boat or Joe Newman at the faceoff X. But, you know, when you don't have a high volume attackman, it makes the transfer class seem, I don't know, less significant, less noteworthy. But all these midfielders that they brought in, you know, they're going to make up basically the entirety of their short stick D midi unit. They brought in, you know, a guy like LeJon Jones, and he's going to be, you know, probably a starting defender. And who are the other guys who are going to kind of take on more significant roles? And when you look at that, you know, I look at people like the Kim brothers, who were Andrew Kim and Justin Kim. Both of them are about 6'4", 6'5". They are two enormous midfielders who transferred in from Syracuse, you know, a few years ago. And now they're going to have to be like take significant minutes on that midfield line. So it's really just about of like, who are the guys who are going to step up into new areas? And maybe they don't get the headlines as much as, you know, a Cursed or Bartolo or whatever, but, you know, it seems like they got the guys to do it.
For sure. And unless you have anything else with the Scarlet Knights, we can move to the midshipmen. Did offensive coordinator Michael Phipps look right back at home?
Well, you know, he definitely does. One of the things that really struck me is, you know, with his familiarity with the academy, and you know, he coached there for a few years. He was part of that. He was on the staff of that team that made that nice run to the NCAA quarterfinals and almost beat Brown in that great crowd. I was at that game. That was awesome. So he was there on staff that Joe Amplo let him do his job. He didn't go in there and, you know, I don't think Amplo went to that side of the field for, you know, most of the, he maybe checked in once or twice. He wasn't micromanaging him. He was letting him have free reign of that offense. He's a guy who knows Navy, you know, it's in his family. He's had relatives who have worked at the Naval, have coached at the Naval Academy before. You know, he was there for a few years. He knows what it's all about. He doesn't need someone breathing down his shoulder. So Coach Amplo let him have the reins of the offense. Talking to Coach Phipps, he wants him to play faster. And you hear that a lot in the fall. I think every coach in the country kind of has this like in their head of like, we're going to dial it up. And then they get to the fall and see where the personnel are and whether they want to dial it up or dial it back. But expect them to play faster and expect some early offense. You know, they can, with those midfielders they have, like the Dane Swansons, they can get some stuff going, you know, in the first 15 seconds of an offensive possession. And I think that's going to be a real danger zone for them when they get into it. So, you know, expect something like to attack early. If they don't have it, maybe they'll resettle and go for something later in the possession. But, you know, I think Phipps is going to look for a lot of early offense there. They're going to rely on that midfield just, you know, really making a lot of noise. And they're going to rely on a lot of plebes, a lot of freshmen, whatever you want to call it. So it's going to be a team that it's funny at Naval Academy, they're not graduating a ton. You know what I mean? They have, I want to say four of their top six offensive players back. They've got, so there's a lot of people on the roster, but it's a really good problem to have is, you know, these classes that they brought in, they have just made everyone better because they are pushing everyone for playing time. You know, I think you're going to see juniors and seniors maybe get pushed off the starting line or, you know, at least their minutes scaled back because of the way that these freshmen are going to come in and kind of boost the overall play of the organization. And, you know, when you look at that, I think you got to start with Mac Haley, who is a guy who is like not the most, and I feel weird saying it, he's not the most impressive to watch, but like he has like kind of like a awkward gait about him, like the way that he runs, but he makes everyone better. And every time he's out there, just like something good happens. So he's got to be a guy that's probably going to be a starter. He's got to be out there as much as possible. Dan Daly might be a starting goalie. Maybe Jack Flaherty was a guy that, you know, when I talk about early offense, he wasn't afraid to sling the ball. There was a few times where I thought he had shots that were like, what are you doing, dude? Like, that's like, you don't want to take that shot. You're through traffic. You got people on you. Just move the ball. But, you know, I think Coach Amplo and the staff liked the fact that, like, you know what? He's willing to do it. You know, he has a confidence that's kind of beyond his years in terms of a guy that's a freshman just, you know, getting used to academy life. So I think we're going to see a lot of freshmen there. Paul Garza had a great practice. Apparently it was his best practice that he had all year. He scored two goals in a scrimmage that they had. So, you know, I think we have a lot of offensive reinforcements for Navy. And remember, Xavier Arline does not play with the team in the fall. He's playing football. So if you can,
fingers crossed, he's healthy this season.
Yeah, if you can account for him in the spring, it's going to be there's a lot coming back, but it's still going to be a different looking team when we get to spring 2023.
I think that was a sufficient podcast.
I think that was great.
Kevin, you know how to bring the enthusiasm.
Learned so much from you guys, you know?
Likewise from you, buddy.
Larry coming out of the midfield. Van Verbeek, where, how do you say his name? Van Verbeek?
Yeah, no, you got it. Nailed
Van
it.
Van Verbeek taking over the reins. I feel like I know these teams in and out now. Come on.
Perfect. Matt, you want to bring us home?
Awesome. Thanks, everyone, for listening. You know, I think we're basically toward the end of fall ball here, which is a little bittersweet. You know, we'll get our weekends back to some extent, but then we're going to go right into fall recruiting, so maybe not so much. We have two events coming up in the first 2 weeks of November, so Yeah, eventually it'll be Thanksgiving and we'll have like a week off. But
and then the NFL season's going to start.
Exactly. We're happy to bring it to you guys. We're happy to be out there on the fields. We wouldn't be doing anything else. So thanks for listening, and we'll catch you later.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.